BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of the Arts and Ideas podcast, where we look at the ideas that are shaping the world we live in, bringing together writers, artists and thinkers to see where their thoughts take us. I'm Preeti Taneja, and I'll be back with today's conversation after this short message.
Hello, I'm Jess Gillam. I play the saxophone, and I really think you should subscribe to my new podcast, This Classical Life. If you're like me and always listening to music, this is a great new way of discovering sounds for your playlists.
It's when I want something really groovy and really funky.
Every week I'm joined by a special guest and we share the latest tracks we just can't stop playing.
I also have this playlist on my phone called 5am and it's full of classical music.
Just head to BBC Sounds and subscribe to This Classical Life.
Hello. Today we're talking language, identity and belonging from the urban streets of Cairo to inner city London via Iran, Somalia and Oklahoma. I'm joined by five writers working in forms from graphic novels to poetry and with at least 10 languages between us, including different forms of English. I'm very grateful that we're all here, but before we get into the political ramifications of that very English sentiment, I'm going to ask my guests to introduce themselves in their own voices, in their chosen language, and of course, in their own words.
I'm Michael Rosen. I'm a writer, broadcaster and teacher. And my father used to call me a yachna, a mashugana and a knacker. So a yachna is a person who talks too much, as I'm doing right now. A mashugana is a crazy person, and a knacker is someone who thinks he knows too much. So that pretty well sums me up.
Thank you.
أهلاً وسهلاً. أنا دينا محمد، رسامة ومصممة مصرية. بكتب رواية مصورة اسمها شبيك لبيك، وعندي كوميك على النت اسمها قاهرة. So that just means, hello, I'm Dina Muhammad. I'm an Egyptian comics artist and designer. I currently have a graphic novel. It's out in Arabic. It's called Shabik Lubik, and I also run a webcomic called Qahira.
Hi, I'm Mumtaza Mehri, and I'm a poet, essayist, and independent researcher. My first languages were Somali and Arabic, and I actually learned English when I was 7 years old, even though it doesn't sound like that.
Hi, my name is Dina Nayeri. I am an Iranian-American novelist, essayist, and now writer of nonfiction. My first book of nonfiction, The Ungrateful Refugee, has just come out. And my first language is Farsi. Salam Behame.
Thanks, Dina.
Hello, my name is Guy Gunaratne. I'm a novelist, a filmmaker. I'm a writer of the novel In Our Mad and Furious City. I was brought up in northwest London to Sri Lankan parents.
So some of you chose not to use English to describe yourselves, and for some, English offers a chance to express how the language is endlessly evolving and made of many other tongues. I think these days it's fair to say that's a contentious opinion, as if we've forgotten how English spread across the world and has evolved as immigrants have settled here in the UK. So why do you think language is so closely bound up with specifically a national identity?
One of the reasons is because English got hijacked, that when Britain was announced as being Britain and that English was the formal language, that other languages were pushed to one side. We must always remember that in the British Isles there's always been many languages. So there has been various forms of what are called Celtic, we'll put that in inverted commas, but we know that Cornish, Welsh, the languages of Scotland, the language of Ireland, which, of course, was incorporated into the Greater Britain. So there always were other languages and always other ways of speaking English. The idea that somehow there is an English, that is the standard English, is wrong. There has never been a standard English way of talking. I mean, I may be talking something that we call received pronunciation at the moment, and it's mostly coming out fairly standard, but it's varied all over the British Isles.
What do you think, Mumtaza?
I mean, I think it's always been closely bound to nationalisms in general. I mean, when I think of Somali nationalism, for example, that's very much based on the idea of like one people, one language, which is a complete fallacy and it's not true. And that bears true, I think, for most nations, if not all. I think it's, again, tied to notions of purity as well. And the idea of like one sort of way of speaking or one speech patterns denoting so many different ideas around, like, for example, class and different sort of ideas that are also, I think, sometimes quite harmful in terms of having like one language, because then the erasure of all these different minority languages and forms of speech is something that's, I think, global. So it's not particularly tied to English nationalism.
Well, I think it has to do with history and preserving a history and signalling, you know, where we're from, what kind of families we're from. In Iran, the way that you speak Farsi and the specific words that you use are so important in signalling your social class. And there are so many, you know, upper class scholarly Iranians who specifically don't want the Arabic words taught to their children. They want to find the original Persian word, you know. And I think that there's something silly about that, because language, you know, it evolves. It's a way of communication. So, of course, if we chose any arbitrary moment to just stop evolving, you know, fine, maybe we would feel a certain level of, you know, accomplishment there. But why that moment? You know, it has evolved up until then. So it feels very, very strange to deny all the subsequent history. You know, yes, we had an Arab invasion. Yes, we have, you know, a mix of dialects. And I think that's true in the West also.
Do you think that there's some similarities in what's happening in Egypt at the moment, Dina?
Well, I can't even kind of begin to encompass this because it's so very complicated. Because, for example, I have no right to be speaking English as well as I do because I actually live in Egypt. And I think, for me, it's kind of a reverse experience than an immigrant's experience, because we have received sort of this imperialist English that we have to speak to be respected in our own country. And so it's a mark of education. It's a mark of sort of... to be taken more seriously. It's a class marker for sure. And I think the way, I think if you look at a lot of third world countries, a lot of us speak too much English. And this is something a lot of Egyptians complain about. But unfortunately, it's also how they implicitly function. And it's a very particular English. And if you have an accent, that also means a lot. And it's really interesting, actually.
That is interesting, especially what you're saying about particular Englishes, Guy. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it has to do with who is included in those conversations when the construct of Englishness was first proposed, or a national conscious was first sort of provoked as the norm. You begin to think, well, if we were to construct an English today with the dialects and the language that exist in the mouths of people, you probably see some sort of disparity that was probably always there in terms of how people speak English, how people relate to one another with the language in this country versus what was sort of constructed as the ideal.
I think that this is a good moment to come and look more closely at the work that you all do. Dina Mohammed, you're in the UK taking part in the Bradford and Shabak festivals. Your work is set in Cairo, and you made your name as the creator of the webcomic Gahira. It's about an Egyptian female superhero who wears a hijab, and she fights for social justice against the patriarchy, against white feminism, against political corruption. I think she's my kind of superhero, and very different from the Marvel heroes that many in the UK grow up with. So who were your inspirations, and when and why did this heroine start to take shape in your imagination?
So one thing I always like to clarify is I actually think of it more as like an editorial strip that kind of uses superhero tropes, because I do think it's quite different than a traditional Marvel comic, which really takes its time to kind of develop superheroes and develop their superpowers very sincerely. And I do think Marvel is doing some interesting work as of late in incorporating that, because superhero comics have actually always been implicitly political in an interesting way. But mine is a very overt, unsubtle, like, issue-based comic. So the reason it started is actually started as a joke. I was reading a really, really bad misogynistic article online, and it was in English, and it was written by Muslim men on, like, a really horrible misogynistic website. I don't know why I was reading it, but I kind of created this as sort of a joke to post. And I just really liked the idea of having a character that was visibly Muslim, and at the time I didn't clarify that she was Egyptian because I was posting in English, didn't think people would care, and then it kind of just really grew from there, and it developed into something that became more and more Egyptian, more and more talking about Egyptian issues, but at the same time it was always bilingual. So I was really interested in how it, because it was posted online, it really developed in that space between like millions of, not millions, that's an exaggeration, but between a lot of international readers and local readers, and just kind of a lot of opinions and arguments. And
so people were giving you their opinions in their own languages, yeah. And then you were incorporating some of that into the work.
Well, I always took the feedback really seriously because I started it when I was 18. So I kind of had that really, when you're 18, you have a really arrogant view on life. I think you're like, oh, I have to say this. And then I got so much feedback that I was like, oh my God, other people are smart. And yeah, and I learned so much making this. I think I received like a full-on academic education making this comic. And it, for me, I think it was fun being able, because it's online, it's flexible, and being able to respond, being able to like post criticisms of the comic like on my own website and being like, actually, I think this is kind of right. And then moving on from there. So I think it's very much been a growth process.
Okay, well, I want to talk about your graphic novel, Shebeg Lubayek, as well. But let's consider a specific image from that book. I'm thinking of the one on your website where there's a swirl of calligraphy that's emerging out of a bottle like a beautiful kind of smoke, as if the Arabic script is about to become the genie. Why did you decide on that for the genie's voice in the novel, and what does it say?
So the conceit of my graphic novel is it takes place in a universe, it's an urban fantasy. It takes place in a universe where you can buy and sell wishes, and they're sold in bottles and cans. And the more powerful, the more expensive a wish is, the more powerful its wish-granting ability. So a cheap wish is kind of like a monkey's paw. It'll grant your wish, but with a twist that makes you regret it. And so the cheap wishes are sold in cans, and the expensive ones are sold in bottles. And the form a genie takes, so once you open the bottle, is it's actually formed of Arabic calligraphy. And it's formed of the phrase the genie asks. So, well, not even a genie, but I think of it very impersonal, so it's not like a person. It was a reason because it's a very commodified novel. The point of the novel is that you've commodified wishes. And so the phrase the wish asks is how what the genie says, really. So in this case, the genie says, what is your heart's greatest desire? In Arabic, it says, Mahiya azra ghubat qalbak. It's kind of like, well, it's very difficult to describe, but it sort of looks like a genie. It looks like a man. And that's actually very common with Arabic calligraphy. It's so often used to make images, to make animals, to make like a lot of organic things. Because it's really flexible.
Yes, and clearly there's a deepening of your feminist concerns in the book, because I think it has a female central character as well. But how do you explore, through the calligraphy and through the form of the graphic novel, the tension between the lure of capitalism and the expectations of tradition that she faces?
One thing I think that's important to note as well is that the cheap wishes, when they come out, they're kind of like scribble monsters. So they're actually like the same Arabic calligraphy, but rather than making like a graceful person shape, they make like a monster shape.
Right.
And it's also like in really bad kind of almost childlike handwriting. And I think part of it, I don't think really it's about tradition, because in this novel, it's an alternative history. And so people have grown up with wishes. My main character, she comes from a working class background, and it's hard for her to buy expensive wishes. And so she's always been exposed to the kind of wishes that backfire and just really damage your life. And so she's always been wary of them. She wouldn't want to take the risk. And so it's really about a novel where she's, for the first time, fighting for the right to make an expensive wish, to make a wish that will actually come true.
And so there's a kind of class struggle going on here.
Yeah, it's very, very much a class-based story, because I think everything in Egypt is viewed through the lens of class.
Yes, I feel that the determination to survive despite social deprivation comes across very strongly in your work, but it also is very important in your debut novel, Guy. In Our Mad and Furious City is set in today's urban London, and it won this year's Dylan Thomas Prize. It voices the lives of Arden, Yusuf and Selvon, all second-generation British. Perhaps you'd read a bit for us now.
Sure, I'll read just a short section from the opening of the book. Our tongues were so soaked in our defences, we hoped only to outlast the day. Just look at how we spoke to one another. Enet though, my man and Pussio. Our friendships we called bloods, and our homes we called our ends. We revelled in throwing crafted curses at our mothers and receiving hard slaps to heads. Our combs cut lines in our hair, and we scarred our eyebrows with blades. We became warrior tribes of Mannem, slave kings and palm-swiping cubs we were. Our parents knew nothing, and most others only knew us from the noise we made at the back of the buses.
Thank you. In the passage, I can hear this narrative voice explaining itself to the reader, but also there's the idiom of the street. The bloods, and it though, my man, sounds from the back of the bus, as you put it. What causes this collective dissonance?
From my experience of growing up in that part of London, the northwest London, it was a place full of friction. If I wanted to capture the essence of what that experience of growing up in London was like, then I don't think I could write it without a sense of dissonance. It's difficult to write a book about London today in a singular voice. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how anyone could do that. So the book is sort of separated into these different dialects that do jar a little bit. And the construction of the book is sort of you jump from one dialect to another, from sort of Western Union Patois to what I could like to call Road dialect or MLE, the contemporary London voices, and then over to Carolyn, the older voice, which is in an Irish dialect, and who speaks to her experience in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. But that jumping from one voice quite quickly to another is how I experienced growing up in London. That's why I wanted to try and evoke.
And you talk about this friction. What kinds of frictions are we dealing with here? Are we talking about immigration or race, or, you know, could you put your finger on some of the ways in which these voices become fractured, become what they are?
I think one of the things that I found interesting, just on a creative level, honestly, was the idea of trying to trace how your social conditioning is inherited through the way you express yourself and the dialect you pick up as we go. There's a whole level to the book that no one cares about except people like me, where you can see how words and phrases from the characters in the past sort of find their way into the mouths of the younger characters, and how those phrases are changed and somehow perverted in a way, or somehow have evolved in a certain way that mean something else.
I actually did want to ask you about one of those older characters, Caroline, and how you came to create her voice and what her claim is on this place and in the story. Is it as this sort of person who creates a language which then gets translated into the mouths of the youngers?
I think, I mean, her experience, set in the 1980s, her experience is as a mother of one of the younger characters, but her experience in close proximity to the Troubles in Northern Ireland, I think for me was a way to explore a voice that carried the trauma of being in proximity to that kind of violence, and how it reflected or perhaps refracted in our contemporary concerns around religious extremism and anyone's human compulsion towards extremes. And I think on some level I've always been concerned about how the word extremism has become so racialized. When I was younger, terrorism, extremism could have been many things. It could have meant the IRA, it could have meant the issues in Sri Lanka where my parents are from, the Tamil Tigers, etc. But today, you say extremism or terrorism, it means one thing and one thing only. And I felt fiction is a great way to do that, to pull those threads, perhaps not searching for answers per se, but explore it in a way that lets you reflect on how these words change, and whether it's for ill or for better.
Can I just
Michael,
chip in there?
Yes, please.
Yeah. There's a really interesting thing going on in your book, which is that we often talk about the idea that we are many tongued around this table, but that actually misrepresents us, because the way we are many tongued is that individually we speak with many tongues. And the wonderful thing about your novel, and indeed all novels, is that novels are usually many-tongued, even when they pretend they're not and are just speaking with one voice. The Russian critic Bakhtin, he talked about the idea that the novel is heteroglossic. It's full of hundreds of different ways of expressing itself, and you've done that. But then wonderfully, in this last section, you've done that really risky thing of going to the first-person plural, the we, which then suddenly unites all this disparateness into this thing. I mean, there are very few narratives in novels that actually use the we. There are some, but I mean, it's quite interesting that you've pulled all that together to give a unity at the end. It's amazing, very risky.
But yeah. Michael, is this a London that Guy's describing that you recognise?
It is. Guy talked about the back of the bus. Well, guess where I am? Usually at the front of the bus. And I listen in. I love tuning in my radio ears and listening to what's going on. And so, yes, that's absolutely. I did actually show my daughter, who perhaps is quite often at the back of the bus, and she was most approving and tried to steal the book off me.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when I speak to them of an older generation, always say, well, yeah, it's not really my experience. But then they always say, but my kids speak like this.
This is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because the critic James Wood, writing in The New Yorker, picked up on this, and he said that you probably average a new word per page. But of course, they're only new if you aren't used
him,
to hearing
yeah,
them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
Or seeing new. Them written down. Why was it important to you to bring these particular immigrant influence, working class languages into English literary fiction which traditionally loves perhaps a more modest, in inverted commas, style?
I've had this question or a variation of this question before. I don't really know how to answer it. I began writing it not really to, in a sense, to please some sort of sensibility that might be or might not be out there. I didn't really think it would ever be published, so I really just wanted to try and, I don't know, render something on the page that I was used to or heard around me. Lots of readers have come up to me and spoken about how, yeah, they'd never seen the way they've spoken on the page like this before. I think it's important because I've always been aware of how those kinds of cultures or subcultures have been represented on either film or television. Historically, a person who speaks this way has always been represented maybe in a clownish way or in terms of to add humour. That's happened with other dialects too, Jamaican, for example, or Irish. Famously, like any time an Irish character would appear on screen, perhaps in the 70s, 60s, perhaps before that, would always be some sort of humorous, clownish caricature. Mm. And that's changed over the course because of art having to reflect it in a more truthful way. And I tried to do that perhaps.
Do you feel like we have more tolerance for different Englishes written down than we do for perhaps different languages in English literature?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not sure.
I mean, when I was writing We That Are Young, which has Hindi and Sanskrit and things, some critics were like, oh, well, you know, it's great that this isn't explained, it's not translated. Others were very taken aback and thought it was very arrogant that I wasn't translating or explaining and said that it wouldn't suit Western readers. But I'm a Western reader, you're a Western reader. We're all sort of Western readers because of capitalism and so on. So what do you think? Is English more tolerated when it comes from idioms and dialects or when it comes from different languages on the page?
I find this really interesting, actually, because for me, I've been sort of translating my own novel and I've been finding it kind of impossible because in so many ways, the way I use language in this novel is so indicative of so many things. So, for example, the class issue is that people from different areas of Cairo, of course from Egypt, speak in different ways. And you use that to signify something, it gives background information without having to deliver it. But when I translate it into English, I mean, I only have the vaguest idea of how a working class English speaker would be, and that's very, again, area specific. So what am I translating to? It kind of sucks the soul out of the novel. And so, like, when I think of translation, I mean, I obviously can't translate the wishes, they're just going to have to stay in Arabic.
Right.
This problem arose with translation of Germinal, Emile Zola's novel, which is written in quite strong dialect, and people have always struggled as to whether how they should represent it. And in fact, it's one of the few examples Guy was talking about, but one of the few examples where the dialect speakers are given credit and honour speaking within the dialect. Another person to think of course, is James Kelman, who won Booker with several novels written in Glaswegian dialect.
Dina Nayeri, I wonder whether you think writing like this works as a way of defying the idea that some people have that immigrants are somehow erasing mother tongues, mother English. A recent poll in America said nearly half of white Republicans get uncomfortable when they hear people speaking in foreign languages.
You know, I think, first of all, just going back to what you were saying before about what people tolerate, I think as writers, it's so important not to think about that. You know, it's not really about what people will tolerate. Like, we are there to represent, you know, a singular, you know, voice and a single experience and to try to, I guess, like, add it to the multitude of voices. And so, you know, over time, of course, then they have no choice. You know, people must tolerate the world as it is. And I guess in my own writing, part of what I think is my job to do for people like that, like the ones that, you know, you're describing, is to bring out, you know, the things that the immigrants and the newcomers bring that enrich our language, you know, like, so for example, you know, often I base a lot of characters, you know, based on my mother, who has this very funny, broken English, which I think sometimes conveys certain things so much better than perfect English. You know, she said to me when I was very young and in tears once, she said, oh, Dina, don't be sad. You're so proudable, you know? And I thought, wow, you know, I would rather be proudable than almost anything, you know? And there's no word, you know, no other word to really describe that.
That's lovely. But there's also a kind of slightly more negative side to the things that you explore in your own writing. And I'm wondering if you could describe what's happening when you come across this thing that I'm going to call the gratitude issue, mm-hmm. where the implication is that you've achieved what you have because of race or religion or class or gender, and so should be grateful for success on those grounds.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I feel like so much is... so much of the way people think starts with a particular baseline, like the baseline of, you know, English is the norm, or, you know, these people belong here and those people don't. And so even if, say, native born of a particular country have had really very little to do with welcoming a new group into their, you know, neighborhood or community, etc., there is this kind of expectation of posturing, you know, of laying down, I guess, all sense of personal power for the sake of, you know, the ones who are already there. And I think that happens in all kinds of ways. It happens in language and adopting language and culture very quickly, and in posturing, you know, weakness in, you know, and submission, I suppose.
From those I can see you're nodding. Is this something that you've had experience of?
It's my initial sort of like encounter with like language in terms of was through Somali and Arabic simultaneously at the same time. And I think I started to kind of see English as I returned it to England and sort of like started school there. I started to see England through like the English language, through the lens of my parents as sort of like a means of survival. And I think I agree with Dina what you were saying in terms of so many languages, especially in like the global south, English is seen as something that's like, it's very class oriented, and it's very much something that it's a mechanism for you to get ahead in the world. And that's really just been my experience. So to be a sort of writer that now sees language as a site of creative expression and play and imagination has been a real transition for me, because I've always thought of it as something that's quite combative. Mm-hmm. And in terms of just how generationally that's manifested in my family through like my grandfather, who spoke Somali, Arabic, Russian, Amharic, Swahili, I could like go on, and Italian obviously. So because of that, he had a different purpose for each language, and that's what he saw them as, and that's the kind of attitude that he passed on to his children, and who are all multilingual. And I grew up in a very confusing linguistic sort of domestic sphere, because it was in one sentence would have Somali, Arabic, Italian and English.
Yeah.
And I would try to figure out, okay, why am I being taught these languages? Oh, they all have specific purposes. And there was really no room for creativity or imagination. It was like, you need to learn this to get through life.
Right. Mm. I want to come back to this idea of having to learn this to get through life, because in your book, The Ungrateful Refugee, Dina Nayeri, you talk about this in terms of how you fled Iran with your brother and your mother when you were a child. Why did you have to leave?
Well, we left because my mother had converted to Christianity, and she was proselytizing. And she was a doctor, so she had many female patients, and, you know, many of them abused, very unhappy. And so she used it as an opportunity to tell them about Christianity, which was, of course, illegal. So she got arrested and was threatened with execution. And so we escaped just before.
How old were you?
I was 8 years old. Yeah.
Right. And you realized very early that learning to speak and write English would be crucial to being accepted. Mm-hmm. Why did you think this was so essential?
Well, I think, there were many reasons, but the most important was that, you know, in Iran, I had a particular identity and my family had a particular identity, and it had so much to do with, you know, our social class and our education. And I suddenly realized we were now going to a place where we had to start over. In my school, you know, I was at the very top of my class, and, I felt that was my primary identity. And suddenly now, you know, I would have to start, you know, from my very first word. My mother had kind of a medical school sort of English, which was very, very choppy. And so when we went to Dubai, we very quickly became undocumented there. The first thing we were doing is just scrambling for old English books, English phrase books, you know, just a way to get back to where we were before, because there was a sudden feeling of having fallen in society, kind of to the place of the voiceless, you know, people who didn't even know the right words to say, let alone could sound, you know, educated.
You also describe in the book these stages of telling your story, which I've asked you to do a little bit today for us. But how the refugee story changes as they go through the asylum process, mm-hmm. these very distinct stages of development. Yeah. What are they?
As a writer, I always knew that, you know, you learn to tell your story a particular way. You know, you learn to tell it the way your grandmother and your mother told stories. And in each culture, that's completely different. But then, you know, refugees arrive and suddenly they have to tell their most kind of fundamental story in the Dutch way or the English way or the French way. And, you know, it's not always the same, even remotely so. In Farsi, you know, children learn to tell stories with a particular phrase, and it says, you know, it goes yeki bud yeki nabud ghair az khoda hich kas nabud, which means, you know, once there was one, there was another, and except for God, there was no one. So it's literally the beginning of the universe. But because, like, in child language, it's so cute to say that, that's how you learn to tell stories. Well, you know what? When you're 30 and an asylum seeker, guess where you start your story? At the beginning of the universe. And that is actually, there's asylum lawyers that I spoke to who said, you know, that's the thing we have to teach Iranians first. Stop beginning so far before your own life, because it sounds like you're lying. You have to learn to tell your story the Western way.
Right. And in the book, you also draw on your experience in the creative writing workshop for refugees in London to show how the process of seeking refuge is exactly this successful refugee story. What's applauded as good writing or literary in Western countries might not fit the culture of storytelling. Would you read that section for us, please?
Sure. Iranians like symbols and metaphors. Lies aren't lies if they point somewhere. And you can signal your trauma and shame with a pointed, "This isn't something for saying." Try that on a Dutch asylum officer who asks, "Why did you run?" Sometimes traumatized Iranians speak in generalities. "The government is corrupt. They're murderers. I cannot say more, please." So, the Dutch officer decides you're lying. He won't change his mind. The English and the American will give you a few seconds more. In Iran, our literature is winding and dramatic. We bury the lead. We flourish and twist. The Dutch and Germans see these as markers of deception. In the Western world, literary critics condemn these techniques as false. To satisfy an asylum officer takes the same narrative sophistication it takes to please book critics. At once logical and judgmental of demeanor, both are on guard for manipulation and emotional trickery. Stick to the concrete, the five senses, they say. Sound natural, human, but also dazzle with your prose. Make me cry, but a whiff of sentimentality and you're done. Stay unseen, but also give compelling evidence of internal change. Go ahead, try it. It's not so hard, you penniless, traumatized fugitive from a ravaged village. Just write a story worthy of the New Yorker.
Thank you, but you also say there's a danger that even if a refugee writes that story that's worthy of the New Yorker, that even, and I'm quoting from the book now, the most lazy and cynical reader won't hear you. Surely then there's no point trying. And yeah. I think that's a point that you have all been making. Better to embrace instead what's in this room, this multiplicity, this energy for something completely and confidently itself. What do you think about that, Michael?
Yes. I mean, let's say who we are. I mean, it sounds very simple. We're sitting here, you know, we're a diverse group in one sense. We're all communicating with each other. There's no difficulty in embracing it. There's also something that struck me very strongly there, Dina, is the idea of what is a fact. Mm-hmm. That once upon a time is not a fact, but yeah. The temperature is 20 degrees is a fact. Mm-hmm. And yet once upon a time is a fact that says, I'm about to reveal to you something of importance. It is a tale that will mm-hmm. be about wisdom and about truth. So it is a fact, but of course, in the way in which Western knowledge chops things up, you know, logical positivism and all that, that it isn't. And so if you, as you say, you know, sit in front of an immigration officer and say, well, once upon a time, it's like...
Well, to them, it's a signal of something different than it is to
yes.
you.
Yes. Yeah. How dare you speak in this way? Because that's fiction, that's fairy tales. Mm-hmm. And yet we accept the idea that in myth and story, there are wisdoms. You know, there are ideas and feelings attached to beings that we care about, and through that wisdom is expressed. Yeah. And yet we don't acknowledge that as fact. It's a whole very strange fissure between the two.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in the case of the asylum officer, it's not necessarily just a cultural gap, but it's also, you know, bad incentives. I mean, they are incentivized to be bad listeners. I mean, they want specifically to find all of those anomalies and inconsistencies and, you know, orphan details that they can use to prove you're lying, when really that's what life is made of, those things, those inconsistencies.
And they are actually storytelling. I was going into America with my family, and I said that we were going to stay with my father's cousin. And we went through, and my son, who at that time was about 6 or 7, an immigration officer leant across and said, "Staying with the family, are you?" So he followed the story. Right. So he was interested in the story in order to check whether I was lying or not.
Exactly.
So, Michael, do you think it's important to get this kind of linguistic multiplicity that we're talking about and this variety of accents and voice into children's books?
Absolutely. I mean, I try myself. I put the Yiddish that my parents spoke regularly into stories, quite often comically, but not always. I've just written a kind of horror story where I get attacked by a mythical beast called the Shloch. And you might ask, what is the Shloch? When my mother said, "Don't be a Shloch," I'd say, "What is a Shloch?" And she'd say, "Well, that's the thing you don't want to be." And that was as near to a definition as I ever got. So, yes, indeed, and there are books and people are trying to do that. And there are bilingual texts or indeed simultaneous sort of books side by side that are in both in two languages. I've been very lucky to have one of my books translated into many languages, and they sit in classrooms and people experiment with it. And that's a good thing.
And that is also something we're going to come back to you, Mumtaza, to talk about. You were recently London's Young People's Laureate, and your work draws on all of the worlds of high and low culture, as well as all the different languages that you were influenced by. You were going to tell us this before, and I'm going to ask you to really pin it down for us now. How did you develop your own voice?
I think my own voice was a mixture of the various literary influences in my own household, because my mother had a degree in Arabic literature in Somalia. And again, I very much agree with what you were saying, Dina, about that whole notion of having fallen down the hierarchy as somebody who comes from a very middle class background in your country of origin. And then now, you know, you enter because of the civil war, you become a refugee, and the sort of the science fiction of that. So my initial encounters, I think, with literature were through the Arabic language and Somali oral tradition as well. And Somali being quite a very poetic language, and poetry being the main form of communication for Somali people and like the most respected art form. And then I think when I started to receive my schooling in English, I was very much interested in English poetry as an alternative canon. I saw of it as like another world amongst all the other worlds I'd already been introduced to. So there wasn't necessarily friction, because I didn't feel like, or maybe I wasn't represented in it. I just considered it to be like another world. And I was very much interested in trying to grapple with that world, and also using music as well, and all those kind of different influences that bled through, and also being able to kind of read bilingually and multilingually and just in general. And all of that, I think, coalesced into this sort of very North London, Somali, British diasporic voice.
I think it's time for us to hear a poem. Would you read Glory Be to the Gang, Gang, Gang for us?
This poem, it was in an anthology recently. And it's generally just an ode to the kind of communal sort of trivialities that I think are quite beautiful to write about sometimes, and that crop up in my work a lot. In praise of all that is honest, lift up the acrylic tips, make a minaret out of a middle finger, gold dipped and counting, in the name of fillet of fish, pink lemonade, the sweat on an upper lip, a backing swell and ache of Abdul Basit Abdul Samad on cassette tape, a clean jump shot, the fluff of Ashanti's sideburns, the rice left in the pot, birthmarks shaped like border disputes, black sand and blessings on blessings on blessings. Give me the rub of calves, rappers sampling jazz, and the char of frankincense, and everything else that makes sense in a world that don't.
So good, man.
Yeah, so good. Thank you so much.
Goosebumps.
Here we are then, making sense with the things that make sense to us, the crossover to the mainstream and back. There's that very powerful feminist statement of the polished nail on the middle finger as minaret, the references to McDonald's, to the skill of the world-famous Qari Abdul Basit Abdul Samad, R&B artist Ashanti, and also to Bollywood heartthrob Shah Rukh Khan. There's a sense of home in the beauty of your language, with the seasonal burst of bakala bought dates and the stark slang English ending as a comment and a kind of truncation. I think it's a poem that implicitly plays with the idea of gratitude and the quieter things that we're honestly grateful for. But looking at the page, because I, you know, read this on the page before I had the chance to hear you read it out loud, it's clear, like everybody else here, that you're exercising some aesthetic rights here to not italicise non-English or non-standard English words in your work. Is that important to you?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of italicisation. I think it's quite unnecessary to kind of indicate here is where the non-English language is. I had to sort of root around a bit to find a poetic voice that I felt fit for me because, again, growing up in a household where one sentence would contain various languages, how do I kind of transfer that into my poetry? And also, how do I transfer the fact that as a member of a diaspora that is quite scattered all over the globe, everybody picked up different languages, and then your cousins are speaking like Swedish or they're speaking Finnish, or and you don't understand each other, but you have to find a common sort of language, and that being reflected as something that is the modern Somali experience wherever you are in the world. And I wanted that to come across in my writing.
And I've got a sneaking suspicion that grammar is quite key too, and it can be used again to get this ethics and politics of what you're doing into the lines of your work. We've got these long lines of memory in the poem, and they contrast to the very sharp full stop at the end. Is that fair? Do you think that you're playing much with grammar when you draft?
I play with structure and grammar and shape and even how it sort of looks on the page, generally because I want it to sort of capture the tone. I feel like sometimes the poems can, just from the way of you looking at it, just on the page and the way it falls and the way the words sort of follow each other on the page, can be quite indicative of the shifts in mood and tone or the sort of swings that you want to create, the highs and lows. So I do try to experiment with that.
Michael, you know, listening to all of this and having worked on these questions of language and identity all of your career, where do you think we are with that, with them now?
I'd like to think we're improving. I mean, I remember when Linton Kwesi Johnson was first writing some 30, 40 years ago, and the kind of hostility that he dared to put down his version of Jamaican Patois, Creole nation language, as Edward Brathwaite calls it, to dare to put that down and to write about it. And he was mocked by somebody quite famously in one of the papers, and the hostility that he met. And I just thought, well, what if you just inverted that and said, well, if you feel that way, just try tuning in. I mean, when we hear different musics, we tune in. I mean, it is very similar to music in the sense that you hear a different scale, you hear a different way of singing, you hear a different tune, and you think, oh, what's that? You know, I'd never heard, say Indian music when I was a kid, and so now I do. I tune in and make an effort, and you find it. But there's the idea that the only thing you should tune into is the, quote, host culture. You tune into Wordsworth, and that's honourable. But if you try to tune into you folks or to Linton Kwesi Johnson or something, or indeed to my Yiddish, then that's sort of an effort. And yet we go do A-level and we tune into Wordsworth or whatever. Yeah. So I think it's a matter of tuning. I do think it's improving.
And Dina, do you think we can say we definitively belong when we start to change the language of the place that we're in?
You mean, is that like a marker of when we belong? I think, no, well, not necessarily just that. You know, I think it's about, yes, bringing our language and our culture and making it part of the norm. But I think also it's the right and the ability of being fully realized characters, you know, not just in our language, but in everything. You know, I think to this essay by Philip Roth called Writing About Jews, I'm sure you know it, you know, and it's where, you know, he had a lot of criticism from Jewish elders for writing these very pungent characters who they said helped the anti-Semites, you know. But then his response to that in this essay was, you know, actually, no, it's to me, like, making a fully realized character, allowing my characters to be good and bad and gray and full of flaws is actually what makes, you know, but it's my stance. It's me saying that, you know, we are the same as them and our individual flaws are just as individual as it would be for someone else. It's not some marker of who we are as a whole. So I think for me, it's kind of more about that next step.
One of the things that comes out of all of this for me is how important it is that people tell their stories in their own words, even when those are fictional people using their own idiom or via lyrical, poetic voice. So perhaps radio is the perfect medium for all of you writers, after all. And as our government of the tongue has ruled tonight, I'd like to thank my guests, Dina Mohammed. You can find out more about her graphic novel, Shebaik Lubaik, on her website, Dina Draws. Guy Gunaratne, who's in Our Mad and Furious City, is out now. And Dina Nayeri, whose new book is The Ungrateful Refugee. Thank you to Mumtaz Ameri and Michael Rosen and my producer, Zaid Worley. On the Freethinking website, you can catch up with my interview with Arundhati Roy and Johnny Pitts on the idea of the African identity. Ciao. Namaste. Goodbye. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this conversation, do sign up to the BBC Arts and Ideas podcast. We're available on BBC Sounds, and there are playlists compiled into headings like The Way We Live Now, Belonging and Home, Culture Wars and Identity Discussions, Prose and Poetry. They're all on the Freethinking programme website. We can also suggest you check out the essay, Thinking Aloud, or the Sunday feature.